Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. I watched a lot of movies this year, and I bet you did too. Some of them were good, some were bad, a few were terrible, but I enjoyed every single one of them. Does that make me a film junkie? One thing is, I'm not alone. Last year, Americans spent more than $11 billion at the box office, and billions more on streaming services. We love the movies so much, we even watch the awards ceremonies, which when you think about it is just kind of weird. We're a nation of film junkies, and today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're going to take that love a little deeper.
Movies puts one into something that I think is closer to the dream state, and I think when you're in that kind of state, you're able to experience parts of yourself that maybe you don't normally think about.
So you can sit in the dark and let a movie wash over you, enjoy the escape from reality. But when the lights go up, it's time to think about what you saw, figure out what you liked, what you didn't, and why. Film critic A.O. Scott does that for a living, and he thinks it matters for all of us that critics play an important role in any culture. He sat down recently to talk with Steve Paulson about his new book, Better Living Through Criticism.
I think we're in a very interesting time for criticism. One of the reasons that I wrote this book and was interested in writing it is there was a lot of stuff being written in 2011, 2012, as I was starting to write this book, about how social media marketing algorithms, user-generated content, reviews on places like Amazon and Yelp, and all of that was going to make professional critics obsolete. What I came to believe was that this was not really about the overthrowing of cultural authority of professional critics, but rather a kind of the coming true or the coming into reality of something that had always really been there, but not as visible, which is criticism as an ongoing public conversation. Sometimes between writers like me and their readers, sometimes just among groups of people who are interested in something.
So do you feel like you have a particular responsibility as a movie critic for the New York Times?
I think I have a responsibility to write as well and as clearly as I can and to back my arguments up with as much persuasive information of whatever kind as I can and to not be stupid.
is it basically to be making an argument about why the movie is either good or bad, or is it more than that?
Yes, I think it's more than that. I think that's certainly part of it. And the tricky thing is that that can only in a way be based on my own understanding of it and my own reaction to it. There's no real set of objective criteria that can be appealed to. So I have to make an argument based on what I think and feel and know about myself in a way about this object, about this movie, about this experience. But also beyond that, I hope, to give them something to think about, something that can enrich the experience of having seen the movie. A lot of people read criticism and read reviews after they've already seen the movie, kind of in a way to go back and see what someone else thought.
Right.
So I'm trying to do that, too, to kind of open up the thinking process about these movies.
So when critics are at their best, what is it that they do?
I always think of critics as writers. Criticism is it's a literary craft. It's an intellectual discipline. So when critics are at their best, they're writing well and they're thinking clearly and they're using their own intelligence to illuminate another piece of work. One of my favorite critics and a friend of mine, Alex Ross, who writes classical music criticism at The New Yorker. And when he is writing well about Beethoven or about Wagner, about a performance of piano music that I've maybe never heard of, I feel his intelligence, his knowledge, his wit, his writing ability activating my own curiosity and my own mind and illuminating this work. So I'll go back and hear things in this music that I never heard before, or I may never hear this music, and I will have learned something about music nonetheless from reading his writing about it.
Well, the other question also is, how nasty should critics get? Because clearly some people just take pleasure in writing a scathing review. And I mean, you've certainly done that yourself, but my sense is you don't really do that a whole lot. That's not your thing.
There is pleasure to be found. I mean, I think it is almost the definition of a guilty pleasure, and it can also be a lot of fun. Because it's often more fun to feel superior to a thing than to feel kind of enthralled to it. And it's easier to feel like you're writing well when you're knocking something down. You can be funnier. You can be scathing. I mean, the resources of invective in writing are quite marvelous. I mean, I try to only do that when I feel like it's really deserved. And I think that that negative, scathing, witty, negative reviews can be a bit of a vice. I think that editors often really like them because they kind of get attention and they're funny. Writers can kind of get a little too hooked on the rush and the thrill and the sadistic pleasure. I think it's a lot harder and a lot more valuable to write just as well, just as clearly, and even to be funny or witty in praise of something. It's harder because you're in a posture of surrender rather than of mastery. You're kind of in awe of something, and sometimes all you can figure out how to do is just to throw adjectives at it. But if you can really explain and tap into and convey your enthusiasm and its sources, that's a very valuable thing to do. And I would say just with movies, there are some movies that I find really obnoxious and demanding of a kind of very harsh sort of punitive treatment.
Well, I mean, you must see a lot of Hollywood crap. And you're, I mean, I'm sure you see all kinds of wonderful movies, too. But
yes. And not only Hollywood crap. I mean, I see, you know, there's indie crap, there's foreign language crap, there's, you know.
But, I mean, it does raise the question of, you know, I mean, what are you supposed to do with a new Transformers movie? I mean, do you even have to review it?
Well, you do, because it's a newspaper, and in a way, the release of a Transformers movie is kind of a news event. So just in a journalistic sense, you have to cover it as you might cover a natural disaster. But I think that even bad movies, sometimes especially bad movies, can be interesting to write about. They can be interesting to write about for the ways that they fail or for even the ways that they seem to succeed. You know, what seems to me a terrible movie can often be a very popular movie. Those Transformers movies make tons and tons of money. And in a way, you can write about that. Well, what is going on here? Why is it that these bizarre, you know, kind of pumped up spectacles about robots from outer space, what is the nature of their appeal? What are they doing? And that's something that criticism can do also, not just offering a kind of thumbs up, thumbs down response, but also kind of going a little deeper and say, well, what does this mean? I mean, if a movie costs $200 million and then, you know, goes on to make $1 billion around the world, that's something that, you know, that you might need to think about and reflect on, and that might mean something.
Yeah. You have a really interesting chapter on the relationship between the critic and the artist. And interesting because there are a lot of people who say that the criticism gets in the way of artistic experience. You know, it sort of saps the vitality out of it. And you say just the opposite, that criticism not only enhances art, criticism itself is a form of art.
Yes.
Which might seem a little self-serving, I might add.
It is a little self-serving. And I am inspired in this by a wonderful essay by Oscar Wilde called The Critic as Artist, in which he makes, in typical Oscar Wilde fashion, all kinds of extravagant and contradictory claims about the primacy of criticism as even superior and to art. But what I end up saying, and what I believe, is that criticism is, first of all, the proper name for the defense of art. It doesn't exist to undermine or to cannibalize or in a parasitic relationship with art, but to support and feed and nurture it. And that, to me, is partly because the impulse, the creative impulse and the critical impulse really exist side by side in us as a species. The same drive that leads us to tell stories, to paint pictures, to make representations of our conditions in the world, that same impulse, or one that is its twin, is the drive to make sense of these things, to figure them out. So criticism is always there, whether it's practiced formally and professionally by people like me, it's always there. It's always part of the life of art.
And one of your points is that artists themselves are basically function as critics a lot of the time. I mean, they are creating art that is in response to previous art.
Exactly, exactly. That criticism is not only alongside art, but is internal to it. So artists look at other work in their own chosen form or in others. They're inspired by it. They're enraged by it. And they want to compete with it. They want to correct it. Sometimes they just want to imitate it. So I think that to me is also a form and a very powerful and important form of criticism that lives inside of the workings of artistic creation. And that's why, to me, criticism is central to whatever is going on when we're talking about and whether we're making or appreciating and consuming works of art. Criticism is always there, even if critics aren't.
And yet the trap I would think that you could fall into or that the artist could fall into is if they're basically always comparing themselves to previous artists, that maybe they should be looking outward to the world, you know, trying to see life in some new and interesting way rather than always referencing another piece of art.
Well, I don't think those things are necessarily opposed. I mean, I think that one thing that you do when you're an artist is you're learning a discipline, you're learning a craft, you're learning how to take your impressions of the world and make them into something else. So I don't think it's just that other art is your subject matter, but it is the context, let's say, that you're working in. And in criticism, it happens that the raw material is other art, which is what makes criticism a kind of a unique and slightly problematic art form. But we are, if we're doing it right, going outside of ourselves and looking at these things out there in the world, that is to say movies or books or paintings or pieces of music, and trying to make something out of our response to them, trying to make something that is original and coherent and that can have some existence of its own in the world. I mean, I don't think that any piece of criticism is necessarily the equal of any work of art, but I do think that criticism is an art form.
A.O. Scott is a chief film critic for the New York Times. He and Steve were talking about his new book, Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. You know, considering all the movies critics see every year, you'd think they'd eventually experience film fatigue, that nothing new could ever be really exciting. But even the most jaded film critics can still be blown away.
This is Manuela Dargis. I'm a co-chief film critic for the New York Times. And if you haven't seen Richard Linklater's Boyhood, which is one of the best movies I've seen this year, and perhaps one of the best movies I've seen in my life, I would really urge you to go see it. Boyhood is an amazing film that follows a boy named Mason from ages 6 to 18. Richard Linklater took 12 years to make this movie, and what he did is every year he would shoot for a couple days using the same characters. Ethan Hawke plays the dad, Patricia Arquette plays the mom, and Eller Coltrane plays the boy Mason. What Linklater did is every year he would convene everyone, and there's a couple years where Ethan Hawke's not around, so clearly he was off making another movie, and he would just shoot these scenes of everyday life. And then after 12 years, he stopped, and he put them all together for a movie that allows you to watch a boy grow up on screen. It blew me away, and I couldn't really fully process why, and I was very deeply moved by it. And then I returned to it a couple times before I wrote about it. And it was one of those movies that I felt that as soon as it was over, I wanted to watch it again. Or actually, what I really wanted to do is I wanted to live inside the movie. Maybe not living with Mason and his family, but I wanted to be in that world. And I could have watched 6 hours, maybe seven. And I kind of wonder when the movie finally does have its own special DVD, if it will have some sort of 6 hour, 7 hour, 8 hour cut. What the movie does is it kind of brings you deeply into the world, everyday world of a child. And actually it opens with a boy staring up at the sky. And he's looking at clouds in the sky. And it's a kind of lovely moment because I think it makes us all think about being a kid and looking at the world. And how do we look at this world? And what you basically watch is you watch that child go from just looking at clouds in the world to living in that world and having to navigate that world. And having a girlfriend and listening to his parents fight and having relationships with his sister and moving from school to school. What's interesting about the movie, just intellectually, is that movies often, they do fudge time and space, and you'll watch, you know, a decade go by. Think of Gone with the Wind, which compresses a lot of time in 2.5 hours or so. And this movie is actually showing you something that you don't see, which is the passage of time. And so the movie itself becomes about time. And when you are thinking about time, you also think about your own life. And what you're watching is how quickly a child grows up. Then you think about how quickly your own life goes by. And so here's a filmmaker who for 12 years followed a little boy and then showed us the labor of that in a wonderful movie that is itself about time, but it also about life.
Manola Dargis. She's a chief film critic for the New York Times. Coming up, we'll revisit a conversation with one of the most famous film junkies of all time, Roger Ebert. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking with and about film critics today. And for years, the most famous and trusted movie critic in America was Roger Ebert. His thumbs up or thumbs down convinced a lot of us to see or to skip a movie. A few years before his death, Roger Ebert sat down with Steve Paulson and reflected on his legendary and prolific career.
I've written reviews that are fairly serious, reviews that are fairly frivolous, and the critics that I like, I read them most of all as essayists, without really wanting to know if I should see the movie or not, because in most cases I have seen the movie, so I don't need to know the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel like you got it wrong? You know, if you see the movie a year later, or you know, after you hear what other people have said about it, you realize you blew it?
That's the most common question that a movie critic gets after how many movies do you see in a week. Have you ever changed your mind on a movie? And I usually answer that question by saying, would that be wrong to do that? Or should one, having been a movie critic for 39 years, never have changed his mind ever? Obviously, over a period of time, the experiences in your life and the experiences you have at the movies allow you to bring something to a movie, let's say 20 years later or 10 years later, that you wouldn't bring or couldn't bring at the time you saw it in the first place. And so I'm sure that my opinions have broadened or deepened. So, yeah, one hopes to be able to grow and learn, sure. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I would think one of the obvious occupational hazards of being a movie critic is you just have to see a lot of junk. You have to wade through a lot of mediocre movies. Does that ever get you down?
No, because I enjoy writing reviews of bad movies. Look at it this way. If you had to see a bad movie, it'd be 2 hours of your life that you would resent because you had lost them and wasted them. I'm paid to be there. I got in free. And I get to write a review about it, in which I get my revenge. As I was watching Deuce Bigalow, European Gigolo, I was not suffering, because with every additional awful moment that went past, I was busily taking notes for my review.
So the worse it is, the more license you have to rip it apart.
In a sense, yeah. Some movies, I think a crime that's worse than badness is boring. In print, I review most everything that I can. I do about 280 movie reviews a year.
280 movie reviews a year?
Yeah.
It's almost one every day.
Well, I have 8 coming out next Friday. And I like to write a lot of movie reviews because I enjoy writing.
You must be very fast.
Well, you know, I'm fast, but I'm not that fast. It takes some time.
How long do you figure a typical review takes you to write?
Some reviews take typing speed. Others can take...
Typing speed?
Yeah. I've written reviews at typing speed. I've also written reviews that took couple of hours and then let them rest on the hard drive and go back at them tomorrow and look at them again. And
you're saying you can write some reviews that would 5 minutes or something like that?
Oh, no, typing speed would still be longer than 5 minutes, I'm sure.
Okay. Do you have any guilty pleasures about particular kinds of movies? I mean, movies that probably in some objective sense are not that great, but you just really like them.
You know, when I saw Basic Instinct 2 with Sharon Stone, I knew that it was a bad movie, and it is a bad movie. But I found myself extremely conflicted about it because it was not boring and it was often awful in extremely engaging ways. I think I said that the role could not be played well, but nobody could play it badly better than Sharon Stone. And I gave it 1.5 stars, and I kind of had a funny little footnote saying that I gave it 1.5 stars sort of like a cold shower to keep myself from giving it 4 stars. Well, in a review like that, what I'm trying to tell the reader is, look, it's bad. We all know it's bad. But of the bad movies that are out there, this one is probably going to entertain you more than most of the others. There's a certain gratitude you have for some kinds of movies that are awful in grandiose or ambitious ways instead of just simply awful through stupidity and lack of any attempt to do anything.
Mm-hmm. When I originally went to see Dumb and Dumber, the person I went to see it with, she was laughing throughout much of the movie, and then when it ended, she said, "That was a really stupid movie."
Yeah, you know,
and I sort of said, "How can you say it's bad if you were laughing during it?"
I think I gave it a negative review, something like 2.5 stars or 2 stars, and yet the scene where the blind boy realizes that his parakeet's head has been scotch taped onto the body. I'm still laughing now when I think about it. And maybe I should have given that movie a favorable review. Another movie, There's Something About Mary. That movie has 6 of the biggest laughs I've ever had in a theater.
With the dogs.
And they
particular.
Are separated by just about nothing.
Yeah.
It's just dead space, enormous laugh. Dead space, enormous laugh. Now, a perfect comedy like the original Mel Brooks producers, the whole movie is great. And you can't say that about There's Something About Mary. But then on the other hand, when you're laughing, you are really, really laughing. And that's, you know, humor cannot be faked.
So as a critic, what do you say about a movie?
I gave it a favorable review while saying that, you know, it's pretty dead in between the laughs. But maybe the dead spaces are just building up to the next laugh in a way, although they're not really very well handled. But the laughs are well handled. You know, it's rare enough to find a perfect movie.
Have there been any perfect movies?
Yeah, there have been some perfect movies. McCabe and Mrs. Miller is a perfect movie by Robert Altman. Mm-hmm. It's a perfect movie. There is nothing wrong with it. Everything is right about it. Every shot, every moment, everything in that movie. It's just a wonderful film. And I can think of some others. O Hazard Balthazar by Bresson, the story of a donkey, is a perfect film. 2001 is a perfect film.
Now, when you look back over the history of film criticism, who are the critics who stand out to you?
Well, the critic that was most important to me was Dwight MacDonald, who worked for Esquire in the 50s when I was in high school. And by reading his column, I became aware of what film criticism could be, or indeed that it existed. And it changed the way I looked at movies. I think that like most people in downstate Illinois, and when I was 14 or 15, I just went to the movie and looked at it and left. And it was MacDonald's example that led me to the art theater in town to begin to see Fellini and Bergman and the British directors.
So what about Dwight MacDonald? What about his criticism?
You see, it wasn't important to me what he said. It was important to me that he said it and how he said it. I liked his style. I liked the way he wrote. I liked his scorn. But it was through the example of MacDonald and other people who were writing in those kinds of magazines at that time, Norman Mailer, Gore Vidal, these people inspired me or taught me or pointed me toward first-person personal essays.
Right. Now, I think some people would say that there have been a few critics who actually changed the way we thought about movies. I mean, sort of who elevated the respect for certain kinds of movies that were just dismissed before.
Well, what happened in the 1960s was that film criticism as a profession and film critics as people became visible in popular culture for the first time. There's been some backsliding since then. Today, most of the coverage of movies in the mass media is simply promotional and celebrity-driven. Nothing amuses me more than these infotainment shows. We've got the first look at the trailer for The Matrix, you know. And then they interview the stars and they visit the set. But they never tell you what they think about the movie. They will tell you everything about the premiere and what people wore and who was there and how much the movie cost.
They don't want to bite the hand that
feeds
them.
But they will not say if they liked it or not, because what they are doing essentially is using their access to this material to put their shows together.
Is this a good time to be a movie critic right now?
Well, it's a good time every time you see a good movie. In my career, I've had a lot of moments when you go into a theater expecting nothing and come out having seen a great film. Oddly enough, Gene Siskel and I had just come back from vacation and walked in on Monday morning to a 10 o'clock movie called Fargo that we, neither one of us, knew anything about. And we didn't even know it was directed by the Coen brothers, and their credit isn't until the end, although you might have guessed that it was. And when you stumble upon a film like this from out of left field, it's such a great experience. When I saw Monster, I expected nothing, and I had no idea that was Charlize Theron, and I never did until the final credits. And what a great movie that was. A Monster's Ball, too, you know, which I didn't expect was going to be anywhere near that good. And I was blown away by that. Million Dollar Baby. Clint Eastwood made that movie with no advance publicity, no interviews on the set, no infotainment profiles, nothing. I received a call. They're going to screen Clint Eastwood's new film. It's called Million Dollar Baby. It's going to be at 10 o'clock on Monday. And I walked into it, and I walked out, and I knew that I had seen that year's Oscar winner. But I had no idea what to expect. I did not know it was a boxing movie.
I'm amazed that that's, I guess, I would have assumed that, someone in your position would kind of know all the buzz.
No, I try to avoid the buzz. You know, you can go online, and there are sites where you can actually read early drafts of the screenplay and hear all about fights on the set and whether the director's cut is going to make it through, and what Harvey is doing, you know, to some poor director. And I'm not interested in that. I want to go in, sit down, and look at the movie. Afterwards, I might want to find out more about it, sure.
Roger Ebert died in April 2013. That was an excerpt from a longer conversation he had with Steve, and you can hear the full thing on our website at ttbook.org. What exactly is it that we love so much about the movies? Sometimes it's sheer escapism, the adrenaline rush of a thriller, the feel-good pleasure of a rom-com. But writer Madeline Sprengnether once had a more profound experience. Going to the movies set her on a journey of self-discovery and even helped her come to terms with the sudden death of her father, all thanks to one film.
That was Padre Panchali, which is a film made in the 1950s by Sajit Ray, the Indian director. It just completely took me off guard, and somewhere towards the end of it, I started to just break down sobbing in the movie theater, not really understanding what was happening. And I just kept on crying and crying in this completely overwhelming way. I think it was for lots of reasons. It's visually very powerful. It's about the death of a young girl and the mother's inability to mourn her death in the immediate context. The mother seems kind of just stunned. And it isn't until later in the film, when her husband, who's been away, returns home and he's brought a present for this daughter who has died, and he's completely unaware of what has happened, that the mother breaks down and starts to cry. But the way this happens in the film is that you hear a musical score. There's no realistic sound. You don't hear the sound of her sobbing. What you hear is this incredibly powerful sitar music. And I think it was the combination of the mother's delayed reaction and this very unusual way of portraying her grief, combined with the fact of the daughter's death, that seemed to kind of tap into a grief that I felt as well, but had so deeply buried that I really didn't have any day-to-day access to it. Movies do something that maybe other media don't do. For instance, when I'm reading by myself, I don't have those kinds of very powerful emotions that movies can stimulate. And I think some of it has to do with sitting in the dark for so long. You spend something like 2 hours and often longer in the dark with a lot of other people watching very big images on the screen. And I think it puts one into a, not a trance state and not a hypnotic state, but something that makes you more vulnerable and I think is closer to the dream state. And maybe it does even tap into those parts of our brains that invent images for us while we're sleeping. And I think when you're in that kind of more relaxed state, that you're able to experience parts of yourself, even though you're watching someone else's story, that maybe you don't normally think about.
Madeline Sprengnether is the author of Crying at the Movies, a film memoir. So for Madeline, watching films helped her better understand her own life. But there are times when seeing a great movie can force you to see other people in a completely different way. And that's the case with Joshua Oppenheimer's films, like this year's Oscar-nominated documentary, The Look of Silence. It's a follow-up to another film he released a few years ago, The Act of Killing. That movie followed a former Indonesian death squad leader as he remembered and even reenacted the atrocities he'd committed. And what's so remarkable about that first film is the level of access. I mean, how often do you see a film told from the perspective of a war criminal? As Joshua Oppenheimer tells Charles Monroe Kane, his subjects were all too willing to share their story.
I had this awful feeling that I'd wandered into Germany 40 years after the Holocaust, only to find the Nazis still very much in power. For 2 years, I filmed every perpetrator I could find across North Sumatra, and all of them were boastful. All of them would, within minutes of meeting me, offer to take me to the places they killed, whereupon when we'd arrive there, they would launch into spontaneous demonstrations of how they killed and complain afterwards that they hadn't thought to bring along, for example, a friend to play a victim or a machete to use as a prop. And so I proposed to them very directly, look, you've participated in one of the biggest killings in human history, and I could be that open with them because they, of course, were that open with me. I want to know what it means to you and to your society. I would say, you want to show me what you've done, so show me in whatever way you wish, and I will film your reenactments, but also your discussions around them.
It's incredible because they're wearing, like, Humphrey Bogart hats, and, I mean, one scene, they're dressed as cowboys. It is so surreal to watch the murders and tortures in that set. And one of the surreal parts of it all is a person. His name's Anwar Kongo. Can you tell me how you met him and how he became the central person in your film?
As I mentioned, I spent 2 years filming every perpetrator I could find. And Anwar was the 41st perpetrator I met at the end of that 2 year period. And in many ways, my first encounter with him was like everybody else. I'd been referred to him by other perpetrators who said, by the time I reached Maidan, a number of people had started to point to him and say, this was really the most notorious death squad leader or executioner in the city. So I approached him one day, and when I arrived at his house, his wife had guests, and he said, okay, I'm happy to tell you about what we did in the 60s, but why don't I take you to the place we did it, and I'll show you what we did. And he takes me to a roof terrace above what is now a handbag store, but used to be a paramilitary office, a newspaper office, and it was the place where they were torturing and interrogating the opponents of the new military dictatorship. When they were finished interrogating them, they would haul them upstairs and kill them on this roof terrace. And Anwar takes me there and shows me how he went about it, and shows me how he used wire to kill because it was relatively bloodless and easier to clean up. And this was the very first day that I met him. And it's an early scene in the film. And after showing me, he does something, in many ways, that was typical of a first shoot with a perpetrator, taking me to the place where he's killed, showing me how he killed. There was nothing unique there, even thinking to bring along props. He brings along a wire. That wasn't so unusual. But what was really unusual was what happened next, where he says, you know, I have nightmares from what I've done. I've been trying to forget it. I go out drinking and taking drugs and dancing to forget what I've done. So he acknowledges a trauma, a pain. And then he says, and to forget all of this, I would go out dancing. I'm a good dancer. Look, and he starts to dance the cha-cha-cha in the place where he's killed all these people, as though almost to banish the horror that he's just described. And the dancing was one of the most absurd, surreal, grotesque, metaphors for what happens when killers win. And I started to wonder, because his pain was right there on the surface, whether perhaps the boasting that so many perpetrators, all the other perpetrators, had indulged in, perhaps that boasting might not be a sign of pride, but might be something much easier to understand, something much more human. I started to wonder whether boasting and remorse are two sides of the same coin.
There's an amazing moment in the film where Anwar, who we're talking about, he's demonstrating how to decapitate someone, and then he stops, and he looks to you and says, I know how my victims felt. I know what it would like to be tortured. And you immediately snap back at him and say, no, you don't, because they're all going to die, and you know you're going to live.
I don't think I was really angry there. I think that I might have been disappointed by his, yet again, when it was clear he was starting at that point in the process to feel some, looked like to me, remorse, that then he tried to run away from it by offering me this kind of easy version of empathy. So like, oh, now I empathize, I know what it was like. And early in the process, I made a decision that I would not make the leap from saying this man has done something monstrous to this man is a monster. Because the former is true. He has done something monstrous. He's done something terrible. But the latter, that the man is a monster, isn't true. The man's a human being. And if we're going to have any chance of preventing killing, we have to understand it. And to understand killing, we have to look at the human beings who kill and listen to them and try and understand what they experience and why.
Has he ever brought up to you, or do you bring up to him, issues of redemption, the idea of trying to earn back or at least pay penance for what he's done?
Only really once, when Anwar saw the film and said to me, there's nothing left for me to do with my life than to die. And that was a terrible thing to hear from someone you care for, especially after it's in response to a film that I've made with him and about him. And I said to him, and I guess I didn't use the word redemption, but I said, you know, Anwar, whatever good you do in the rest of your life isn't undermined by the bad things you've done in the past. That's not to say that in the sort of calculus of justice he could ever make up for what he's done, but he could live the rest of his life with some meaning.
What about you? You spent all these years making and hearing all these atrocities, watching all these reenactments of real murders and real tortures and real rape. How did you hold up during all those years filming that? What were your dreams like?
There's a scene where Anwar shows how he might have killed a child by butchering a teddy bear. And it starts as a game with Hermann dressed as a fat gangster in a fedora and a suit. Hermann, Anwar's portly sidekick and protege, improvising as part of his kind of game, the mother of this teddy bear, trying to bribe Anwar, save his own life or her own life in the context of the game by offering her daughter to Anwar. The daughter's just this little stupid teddy bear. And Anwar butchers the teddy bear. And I think what was most chilling there is he blames Hermann. He says, you're the real barbarian. He blames the victim. And of course, the whole fantasy of the victim trying to save herself by offering her daughter is a lie in the minds of the perpetrator to help justify what he's done. It's a moment where the film is not giving you any kind of glimpse on what happened, but a glimpse into how the perpetrators justified in their darkest moments. And when we were shooting that scene, Anwar's microphone was rubbing against his suit, and I had to call cut to fix his microphone. And Anwar looked at me and said, Josh, you're crying. And I felt my face. I didn't know I was crying. It's the only time in my life where I found that I was crying without realizing. And I said, wow, so I am. And Anwar said, what shall we do about it? And I said, well, we'll continue shooting the scene, which we did, obviously pushing myself beyond some threshold. I went home that evening feeling utterly tainted, like in order to deal with the trauma that lurks just below the surface, I've had to immerse myself in it and tainted by it. And that was, in my mind, the beginning of about 8 months of really terrible nightmares where I would wake up, not be able to sleep for the rest of the night. The next day, I would be afraid of sleeping and have insomnia. The next night, it would start again. That went on for about 8 months. I got through it because of my wonderful Indonesian crew. These are people who remain anonymous still to protect their safety, and my family. But it is very emotionally impactful. There's no denying that.
You know, Joshua, in the end, after all the surreal reenactments and gut-wrenching admissions and just an intense film, one of the most powerful moments for me in the film was this mundane moment in a car where one of the leaders of the genocide says to you, "Hey, Josh, war crimes are defined by the winners. I'm a winner."
And I get to make my own definition.
And I get to make my own definition of what that means. Did they win?
They won. I mean, that's what the film's about. And it's the whole raison d'etre of this film. The reason I made it is because it's an expose of what happens when the killers win. And somehow I have this feeling that that's not the exception to the rule. Genocide, we think, okay, the Nazis, we think the Khmer Rouge, they were thrown out of power. There have been tribunals. There's been some form of justice, however incomplete and impartial. But I would suppose that's the exception to the rule, that perpetrators of mass political violence normally win and then normally take power. And that's why they perpetrate the violence. If every time it happened or most of the times they have their comeuppance, they wouldn't do it anymore. And then all that's unique in Indonesia, perhaps, is the boasting of the perpetrators. That's an allegory for the rule, a metaphor for the rule. And the reason they boast is simply the rest of the world, at least the Western world, supported them at the time of the killings and have supported them enthusiastically ever since. And they know that. So when they meet a foreigner with a camera, they don't think this is something they should be ashamed of. They boast, and they boast openly.
Joshua Oppenheimer, talking with Charles Monroe Cain about his documentary, The Act of Killing. Oppenheimer's most recent film, The Look of Silence, is one of this year's Oscar nominees for Best Documentary. Coming up, a black film critic takes on the controversy over racial diversity in this year's Oscars. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. The big controversy surrounding this year's Oscars isn't so much about the films that made the cut, but those that were passed over. No significant award nominations went to people of color this year. And that, of course, led to the Oscars So White campaign and to a serious discussion about racial discrimination in Hollywood. This is a subject Mike Sargent knows a lot about. He's one of the few film critics of color in a largely white industry and the co-founder of the Black Film Critics Circle. So what did he think when he heard about this year's nominations?
To be honest, you know, the whole Oscars So White campaign, I'm very glad it's happened. I'm glad it's shown a light on this, but it did not surprise me. My feeling is that the voters, let's put it this way, it's not what they care about, you know, and I can't blame the Oscars completely because, you know, this is an industry-wide thing. It is a white male-dominated industry. So if that's the industry, that's the dominant culture, of course.
You're reminding me there was an Annenberg report that came out recently. You know, it surveyed more than, I think, 400 movies and TV series from the past couple of years, concluded, as you're saying, that Hollywood suffers from an epidemic of invisibility. But one of the points that the study made that was interesting to me is they said, if you really want to improve diversity in Hollywood, one of the most important places to start is behind the camera, not necessarily in front of the camera. Sounds like you'd agree?
Well, unequivocally, I agree. Here's the deal. You know, human beings, I think, by nature are tribal. You know, there's a natural us in them. And if you are very used to certain things being a certain way, it's not even going to occur to you for it to be something else, you know? And that's not to say that a writer or a director can't, you know, a man can't create a realistic female character and a female can't create a realistic male character. But what are the chances that if a film about women is written, directed, and produced by men, even though it stars women, what are the chances that they're going to get it right and they're going to really create three-dimensional characters, and what are the chances that it's not?
Mike, I'm curious, is this an issue for black actors and actresses? Like, will they look at a project and think, yeah, it looks great, but, oh, white director, white producer, white writers, I just don't think I want to do that.
No, you can't. That's a luxury you can't afford when you're a black actor. You can't afford that. But you also have to look at the industry and where are the best black female actresses right now. They're all on TV.
Are there ways you yourself, as a black film critic and filmmaker, have been made to feel like an anomaly in Hollywood?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there isn't a black film critic that will deny this. There is a tendency and almost a policy within the PR companies. Some of the big studios will hire a sort of a boutique agency to handle the quote-unquote black press. And they're handled.
Wait, you're not just treated like, aren't you just press?
No. You are not just press. And here's the other thing. If there's a film and they feel that they're interested in the black audience and the black demo, they will hire those boutique agencies to quote-unquote handle you. And if there's 4 hours of interviews, they may give the black press 20 minutes, a half hour, and they have to divide up among all the black press. And at the same time, a big movie like Batman versus Superman, you know, you can't get into that one. They're not going to let you be part of that press conference or fly you out for that junket because they know, you know, honestly, and I have to say, in some ways, from a business standpoint, I understand, they don't have to.
You really feel like you've been excluded from press events because of your color?
Absolutely. But it's not just me. That was part of the impetus to wanting to create the Black Film Critics Circle, which I co-founded with some other black critics.
I think some people might look at this whole issue about the Oscars and think, well, you know, it's largely about symbolism and prestige. But are there real economic consequences when African-American filmmakers and actors get passed over?
Well, of course there are. There are serious economic consequences. And, you know, why is it an actress as great as Angela Bassett hardly gets work? If you think about it, well, what roles could she have played? Mm-hmm. What films are there? What strong female roles? I mean, there's a paucity of great female roles to begin with. But what female roles are there for black actresses? And part of that has to do with what stories Hollywood is willing to finance. So if you're only going to finance stories that appeal to white people, that are about white people, you know, where characters of color are nominal, there's just not that much to go around. But if you win an Oscar, you then are put to the forefront. But it doesn't always mean you're going to get work.
And then in terms of trying to diversify the power structure in Hollywood, and especially on the Academy. I know Cheryl Boone Isaacs, the current president of the Academy, has, in the wake of this year's controversy, promised a review of recruitment offers, says it's time for big changes. What changes would you want to see?
Well, I would want to see it. The Academy needs to be more inclusive. You know, if they take that position, then hopefully Hollywood will follow. But there's a bigger issue that hasn't been discussed, and that is distribution. We live in an age where there's a global marketplace for film. You can have a film that only makes $150 million here in America, but it can make $450 million overseas. Mm-hmm. And that's increasing more and more and more. But here's a problem. Now, because I'm both a film critic and a filmmaker, I've encountered this as a filmmaker, especially with my first film, and I have a lot of black filmmaker friends. Here's what Hollywood will tell you. Black films don't travel. That's what they'll tell you. Black films don't travel. They don't do well overseas. But what it really means is that they don't, you know, if you got a film like Straight Outta Compton, now that's a film, hip-hop is universal worldwide. There's Russian hip-hop, German hip-hop, Israeli hip-hop, Italian hip-hop. Okay, so clearly that music and a film about that should be playing in every country. But it's not. It's been in a few select markets. So here's what happens. You know, black film in many ways, you know, is a ghetto. There's only certain kinds of black films that get made. But at the same time, if you have to live or die by your domestic take, that means there's never the opportunity for black films to reach those upper echelons. So it never has the opportunity to get out of this economic ghetto to become a major force, a financial force for the studio.
Mike, last question, and I'm pretty sure I know what you'll say, but explain why this matters outside of Hollywood, outside of the film industry.
Well, I think it matters for a myriad of reasons. But the reasons that mean the most to me is, just like what you said, people enjoy seeing themselves on screen. You know, if it weren't for Star Trek, for instance, there are a lot of people who would have not gone into science, who would have not, you know, gone into engineering, who would have not gone into any number of things that influenced them from seeing it. You know, film is probably the most powerful storytelling medium ever. And it has the ability to not only open your mind, but to change your mind, to influence your thought, to influence the way you see things. I think that film is a medium, depending on what the film's about, it can be inspirational. It can, you know, if a film like Concussion can make people realize just how dangerous football is, or a film like The Big Short can let us have a better understanding of how finance works and how we're getting screwed over. You know, film can be a great agent of change. And if you're not allowing people to tell their story in this fantastic medium, we're denying a big part of the human experience, not to mention rewriting history ongoingly.
Mike Sargent is a film critic and filmmaker and co-founder of the Black Film Critics Circle, which just came out with their own awards. You'll find a link to their top film picks on our website at ttbook.org. That's it for this hour, but there's more in our podcast feed. To subscribe, look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. That way you'll never miss a show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced this hour, with help from Craig Ely, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Until next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.